Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Adina Barel, a professor of Jewish literature and expert on European newspapers for Jewish children in the period between World War I and the Holocaust. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This has been a quieter week in Israel, which is a blessing indeed. The ceasefire with the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas in Gaza ended a couple of painful and very stressed weeks in the Holy Land. And while there are mixed results from the Pillar of Defense conflict, the general sense is that it ended at about the right time, before Israel was forced to send in ground troops. An occupation would certainly have increased casualties for both Palestinians and Israelis, without necessarily changing the situation permanently. Through the Egyptians, Israel and Hamas have worked out what may prove to be a lasting truce. We will see what eventually transpires, of course, but the end of war, even a minor war, is a good thing. By contrast, 4 years ago, Israel's Operation Cast Lead at this time of year included a major ground operation. It ended with the near-complete Israeli tactical victory and defeat of Hamas, with great destruction of the Islamist terrorist group's military capabilities. But in a strategic sense, it actually accomplished very little because of the serious damage Israel's reputation took in the international community. Over 1,200 Palestinians died. 13 Israelis were killed, and the international condemnation of Israel 4 years ago, unfair though it was, including the Goldstone Report, had a negative effect worldwide. And the end result of Operation Cast Lead was not very satisfying for Israel either. In a relatively short period of time, Hamas's military capacity was rebuilt with Iranian money and arms, and this time around they were able to fire rockets even farther into Israel. Perhaps this indirect negotiation of a ceasefire through Egypt and the truce before Gaza has to be invaded again undoubtedly prevented far more casualties and will, in the end, be a blessing. We can, of course, hope that this time rocket fire will finally be eliminated from the lives of Israelis, or at least for the foreseeable future. The forum has now shifted to the UN, where the non-Islamist Palestinians of Mahmoud Abbas's losing Fatah party, losing in the sense of public opinion, are in quest of ever greater recognition as a kind of semi-state. And all of this qualifies as a quieter week in Israel. My. In any case, that means we can focus a bit more on the build-up to the minor but very much favored Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, which begins this coming Saturday night. The 8 nights of Hanukkah represent an opportunity to renew our commitment to Jewish identity. And an interesting key to this festival is the time of day that it occurs, or rather, the time of night. As you probably know, all Jewish holidays begin at sundown, but none are quite so night-oriented, not even Passover, as Hanukkah is. Bringing light into the season of the shortest days and longest nights of the year, Hanukkah is that rare Jewish holiday in which nearly all the observances are after dark. Sure, it's Hanukkah during the days too, but it's the magical lighting of Hanukkiyot, Hanukkah menorahs or candelabra, each night of the long festival, adding one more light each night that is the central observance of Hanukkah. We are commanded to fulfill the great mitzvah of Pirsomet HaNes, publicizing the miracle of God's redemption at this time of year in those days long ago. And nothing does that better than lights burning brightly in the window, reminding us of the miraculous quality of God's redemption. Although considered a minor festival on the religious calendar, in America, Hanukkah has become something quite major. In part, this is because of its proximity to that other end of the American calendar year holiday that everybody likes to celebrate so thoroughly. You know, Kwanzaa. In part, it's also because Hanukkah is a festival that celebrates religious freedom, the right to worship God as we choose. Without the events that we commemorate at Hanukkah, the victory of the small Jewish guerrilla band led by the Maccabees over the mighty Syrian Greek army of the Seleucid Empire in the years 167 to 165 BCE, well, without that, the belief in one God would have been destroyed and all religious freedom eliminated. There would have been no Jews, which means no Christians and no Western civilization, and for that matter, no Muslims, since both Christianity and Islam are direct daughter-descendant religions of Judaism. The story of that great revolt, catalyzed by the egotism of King Antiochus Epiphanes and his need to be not only obeyed but worshipped, is an underdog narrative. It's about how a group of Jews refused to bow down to an idol or surrender their right to study Torah and educate their children in the belief in God and the moral and practical principles of Judaism. They fought and died, but eventually triumphed. And when they recaptured the temple in Jerusalem, they cleansed it and relit the great menorah, dedicating it anew to worship and holiness. Chanukat HaBayit, the very word Chanukah, meaning dedication. So when we celebrate this week eating anything fried in oil, especially latkes, the fabulous potato pancakes, by the way, my wife Wendy and I have a great sweet potato latke recipe, we are celebrating something more than a children's festival. We are enjoying our religious freedom, which was established nearly 2,200 years ago by the Maccabees this coming week. To play us in on this theme from our pre-Hanukkah musical preview, here's a lovely choral version of the prayer sung after lighting the Hanukkah candles, Hanerot Halalu, These Lights, by Hugo Adler. That was Hanerot Halalu from our pre-Hanukkah musical preview in honor of the rapidly approaching Festival of Lights, which begins this Saturday night, December 8th. Just six more shopping days until Hanukkah, folks. Even with Amazon Prime, you have to hurry. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll find out from our guest, Dr. Adina Barel, how it was the Jewish children in Europe before World War II had two very different regular newspapers to choose from. Both excellent and of completely opposing viewpoints. Find out why when we come back on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Adina Bar-El, a children's author and editor and scholar. She is from Tel Aviv and now lives as a member of Moshav Nir Yisrael. She got her BA in Literature and Tanakh Bible Studies from Tel Aviv University and eventually wrote her PhD thesis on children's newspapers written in Hebrew and Yiddish in Poland between the wars from Hebrew University of Jerusalem.
Yes.
She has written 19 books for children and teens, a volume of poetry, some nonfiction, and two books of her own scholarship. It's really quite an accomplished woman of letters. We welcome the two Jewish Boker Tov, Dr. Adina Bar-El.
Boker Tov. I'm glad to be here.
What interested you in your scholarly work in writing about kids' newspapers?
I'm an author of children's books, and I wanted to research the way of life of the community between the two world wars in Poland, because I'm a daughter of survivors. And I heard my mother told me many stories since I remember myself about her being in the ghetto and in the concentration camps. By the way, my father had been in Auschwitz, but he didn't want to tell me anything because he wanted us to be happy and not to be sad. And he told us only cheerful stories. But I wanted to come to Poland and to see what my mother had been told me, the concentration camps, the circumstances there. And then I went to Poland the first time with my students. I was a teacher in the Kfar Silver. It's an agricultural school in Chof Ashkelon. My first visit in Poland was very, very difficult for me because I realized that what I had known before that, I realized how the Nazis planned all the mass killing of the people, because in Auschwitz you can see on the walls the plans, the maps, the pictures of prisoners, and
the
so
systematic
on.
Approach
yes,
to the destruction.
Systematic, yes. And when I came home, I didn't intend to write anything about it, but a few months after that, the Gulf War broke out and Saddam Hussein sent missiles to Israel. And one day I stayed at home with my daughter that was 14 years old that time. And in the radio and in TV, they said that we had to stay at home and not to go out. And suddenly I began to write a book about Poland and about the concentration camps and a visit of a group of students from Israel, but in a point of view of a student, a young student, 16 years old, and not a point of view of a teacher as I had been there. And this visit caused me to decide that I want to do my PhD dissertation about, not about the Holocaust, about the Shoah, but about the very rich lives in Poland between the two world wars. Because I realized how this community was very rich mentally and from many aspects and heterogeneous. And I saw for example, in the Warsaw Cemetery, headstones of writers like Anski, Peretz, and Dinezon, and headstones of Bundist people and their opponent, Zionist people. And it occurred to me that these are my roots.
Fascinating beginning, and we'll talk much more with author and scholar Adina Barel when we come back on Too Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the switcher credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com, where you can stream us. or hear all past and present shows through the website, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We continue with our pre-Hanukkah musical preview with a very fun version of a classic Hanukkah tune reimagined by Kenny Ellis, Sevivon Sov Sov.
Sof sof sof, Chanukah hu chag tov, Chanukah hu chag tov, Sevevon sof sof sof, Chag simcha hu la'am, Nes gadol haya sham, Nes gadol haya sham, Chag simcha hu la'am.
That was Sevivon Sov Sov by Kenny Ellis for Hanukkah, coming up this Saturday night. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
All right, so now we have a ceasefire with Hamas. Is this likely to mean peace in some sense?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as meaning peace. It's a ceasefire. I don't think we should expect anything more than a ceasefire. We know that even after the ceasefire, we had one case of a terrorist that found his way to get into Israel and reach a local mushav about 2.5 miles away from the Gaza Strip and entered a house at 3 o'clock in the morning and tried to attack the family with a knife. And luckily, the mother there, a very Jewish mother, I would say, was able to struggle with him and to kick him into the bathroom and lock him in there and basically rescue her kids. So I don't know if peace is something that we can expect at the nearby future. I wanted also to raise a point that many Americans are not aware. The last operation, Pillar of Defense, the name of the operation, I'm not sure how many people are aware of the source of the name, and I think that for a program like this, for Two Jewish, it's really interesting. The names come in Hebrew, it's Amud Anan, Pillar of Cloud, which it comes from the pillar of cloud that walked in front of the people of Israel in the desert when we came out of being slaves in Egypt all the way to the promised land, to the land of Israel. And God protected the people of Israel and showed them the way with a pillar of cloud during the day and a pillar of fire during the night. And that's the source of the name, Pillar of Defense. And I thought it's very interesting from a Jewish perspective to see that even the IDF today, when they go into an operation to stop rocket shootings from Gaza, they have this Jewish sentiment in even the names that they choose for the operation.
It's like the old Chalutz idea, you know, the Bible in one hand and the rifle in the other, still informed by the tradition. How effective, in your view, was the Pillar of Defense, was the Amud Anan, which was designed to stop rocket fire?
This will be basically need to be answered by time. We'll need to see how Hamas and Jihad Islamic and other terrorist organizations behave. But I do think they got a significant blow from the IDF. I also think that the Palestinian civilians got a very clear message that the IDF is trying very hard to target only the terrorists and to avoid civilian casualties. They also got the very clear message that Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other terrorist organizations are using them as human shields. And I do hope, looking at the Arab Spring, looking at other events across the Middle East, that maybe those Palestinian civilians will take the power into their hands and tell to terrorist groups like Hamas, like Jihad Islamic and others, no more. We are dead tired with this basically stupid conflict. We just want to live our lives. That's our hope.
We can hope. Hatikva. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, the recent war in Gaza somehow manages to bring out anti-Semitism in various places of the world, nowhere near. Let's talk a little bit about that sort of persistence.
Well, it's a very interesting question because anti-Semitism seems to be one of these phenomena, sets of feelings, which every time you think you've driven the silver stake through its heart once and for all, it still emerges from the dead like a vampire or Frankenstein or something. Probably mixing metaphors here. Sorry about that.
But, yeah, but sometimes in Transylvania itself.
So. Right, right. So, I mean, in this case, first of all, there was this horrible thing in Hungary where one of the right-wing party leaders demanded a list of every member of the government, parliament, et cetera, who was Jewish because they all posed security threats to the Hungarian state, which is almost unthinkable. And the head of the government apologized because obviously in a country which was as devastated by the Holocaust as Hungary was, this kind of thing raises bad memories that aren't so distant. But it leads to a broader question because there have been anti-Semitic outbreaks that are not clearly limited to Israeli targets like the Israeli embassy or the Israeli cultural center, but rather Jewish targets like local synagogues or Jewish community centers, thus debunking once again the claim that, oh no, we have nothing against Jews, we only have a problem with Zionists and the state of Israel and its imperialist policies, which is yet another thing to come to, is how Israel is characterized and whether those characterizations are even remotely fair or whether they too are shaped by a long history of anti-Semitism in what is historically Christian Europe. But if we look at Spain, even countries that once were considered very friendly to Jews and to the state of Israel, like Denmark,
right?
And then if we look at countries where anti-Semitism seems to be in mother's milk and in the soil and in the water, like Ukraine and Russia, we see, I mean, that it takes very little to awaken the old flames of anti-Semitism. It's like there's glowing coals there, and the slightest breeze will make them leap into a full flame. And I think one of the explanations for this, or a partial explanation at least, is that the so-called Jewish question in Europe was never really answered. The process of answering it, which began with Napoleon and the emancipation of Jews and tearing down ghetto walls all across the continent, that began the process of answering or resolving the Jewish question. But then it was put on hold by World War I, by the Holocaust, World War II, and the creation of the State of Israel. All of these things seem to interrupt the process of addressing the question of how do we regard the Jews? What do we do with them? Are they a separate nationality? Should they all move to their own nation state? Is there a role for them in our nation? Can we be a multicultural nation? And this goes to the heart of one of the crises currently facing the European Union, about which I guess we can talk next week.
Sounds like a great plan. Thanks, Tom, and we'll see you on Hanukkah.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A woman walks into the post office to buy stamps for her Hanukkah cards. She says to the clerk, "May I have 50 Hanukkah stamps, please?" "What denomination?" asks the clerk. And the woman answers, "Oy vey, my God, has it come to this? Okay, I'll take 6 Orthodox, 12 Conservative, and 32 Reform stamps." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, just for Hanukkah. This time, a special feature of Too Jewish for You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Vayeshev, which begins the story of Joseph, one of the great narratives in all literature. will continue with this fateful tale throughout the rest of the book of Genesis, and the extraordinary plot lines involving Joseph eventually set up all of early Jewish history. But first, Vayeshev starts by further illustrating the exploits, good and mostly bad, of one of the truly spectacularly dysfunctional families in all of history, that of our great patriarch Jacob and his four wives and 13 children. If you thought the Borgia family had problems, if you believe that Oedipus had a bad home life, if you feel that the Kennedys were cursed, if you think that the Kardashians... never mind. Anyway, for the others, none of these epic familial failures have anything on Jacob and his brood. In fact, you can make a case that the Jacob clan had some of the troubles of each. In addition to the vigorous rivalry between the varsity wives, Leah and Rachel, until she dies giving birth to the 12th brother, Benjamin, the built-in rivalries between the JV wives, Bilhah and Zilpah, the phenomenal sibling rivalries that take place among all the 12 vigorous, manipulative brothers, all abetted by truly lousy parenting by the patriarch Jacob, there is also plenty of just bad luck. There are betrayals galore, rape, revenge killing, incest, mass circumcision, mass slaughter, massive deception, conspiracy to defraud, and of course, selling a blood relative into slavery in a foreign country. Frankly, this is not the conduct we prefer to see in any families. But with all the action of every kind in Vayeshev, there is also a moment of pure fate. An incident that illustrates something greater than mere human weakness is at work here. Earlier in the Parsha, Joseph is sent by his father to spy on his brothers. Jacob suspects that the boys, young men by now, have been taking care of Dad's sheep, but probably selling a few on the side to make a few extra shekels. While searching for his brothers, Joseph gets lost and wanders helplessly until, we are told, he bumps into a stranger who sends him to find his brothers. When he gets there, he sets in motion events that land him in slavery and prison in Egypt, and eventually lead to the whole family going down there and being enslaved, and a few centuries later getting freed, crossing the Red Sea, and getting the Torah. And, well, the world has never been the same since. But none of this would have happened if Joseph hadn't bumped into a friendly, anonymous stranger who helped him out. That is, all the turbulence, energy, and activity of Jacob's family would not really have mattered if not for a nameless stranger who sets our story onto its true course, one that will eventually end in peoplehood and a great posterity. First, one simple, nameless guy had to point the way. The moral of the story? You never know just what your own small act can do for somebody else, or how it might even affect history. So, in this coming holiday season, why not take a moment and do something for somebody else, even somebody you don't know? You, too, might make the world a better place and shape the future, no matter how well-adjusted your own family is. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Dr. Adina Bar-El, will explore ways in which Jewish literature has developed in Europe and Israel, and just what makes for a great Jewish kids' book. Right here on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Negotiators for Israel and Hamas continued holding separate talks with Egyptian mediators in Cairo, parallel talks, to iron out the details of last week's ceasefire. The Egyptian brokered ceasefire between Israel and Hamas went into effect, ending 8 days of Israel's operation Pillar of Defense against Gaza. Six Israelis, four of them civilians, and 167 Palestinians, both terrorists and some civilians, were killed during the operation. More than 1,500 rockets were fired at Israel by terror organizations in Gaza during the operation, and Israel said it attacked more than 1,000 terror targets in the coastal strip. Among the topics being negotiated are loosening the restrictions on people and goods traveling to and from Gaza, as well as putting a halt to all arms smuggling into Gaza. Good luck. Israel will not negotiate directly with Hamas. It has designated Hamas a terror group, as has pretty much every civilized country in the world. Gazan farmers and demonstrators tested the limits of the ceasefire, entering a no-go zone that Israel established near the border. On November 23rd, one Palestinian was killed when he approached the border fence with Israel in company with, well, a mob. But unlike previous ceasefires, this time Hamas seems intent on preserving it and maintaining discipline in its ranks. May this ceasefire prove to be more than a temporary respite from the rockets that have slammed into southern Israel. In other news from Israel, Israeli Defense Minister and former Prime Minister and past guest of Two Jewish, Ehud Barak, announced his retirement from politics last week. "I have exhausted the practice of politics," Barak, Israel's defense minister, said. "There is space to allow new people to enter senior positions in Israeli politics. Replacing those in positions of power is a good thing." Barak's political career may have been over even if he had not decided to retire. His small centrist Independence Party faction was polling very poorly ahead of Israel's January 22nd elections. It's possible he might not have even made it into the next Knesset if he had decided to run. Barak will stay on as defense minister until a new government is formed. As Prime Minister of Israel from 1999 to 2001, Barak withdrew Israeli forces from southern Lebanon and offered unprecedented concessions, including parts of Jerusalem, to Yasser Arafat and the Palestinians at the tragically unsuccessful Camp David peace summit. In the 2001 elections, following the outbreak of the Second Intifada, Barak was soundly defeated by Ariel Sharon and then resigned as head of the Labor Party. In 2007, however, Barak mounted a political comeback, recapturing the leadership of the weakened Labor Party. He returned to government as defense minister, a post from which he has emphasized the threat from Iran's nuclear program and ordered the two military operations into Gaza, 2008's Cast Lead and the recent Pillar of Defense campaign. Barak brought credibility to the position of defense minister. He had a tremendous military career, serving as head of the IDF, Israel Defense Forces, as chief of staff in the 90s. He became the most decorated soldier in all of Israeli history. Proud of his decades of service in the elite commando unit Sayeret Matkal, Barak would tell stories about his secret missions targeting terrorists, including a famous one in which he entered Beirut dressed as a woman. In the end, though, politics might have done him in. A close relationship with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, dating back to the days when Barak was Netanyahu's commander in Sayeret Matkal, pulled Barak progressively further from many in his center-left Labor Party. In 2011, he split off with four other Knesset members to form the Independence faction. Before he announced his retirements from politics, Independence was polling at anywhere from 0 to 4 seats in the next Knesset. Although Barak's performance in the Pillar of Defense campaign, widely considered excellent, boosted his popularity. But Ehud Barak's decision not to run for re-election may not necessarily mean the end of his career in government. There are always second chances in Israeli politics. Some political observers speculate that if Netanyahu is re-elected, he might reappoint Ehud Barak as defense minister, even though Barak wouldn't be holding a Knesset seat.
Mut dit Ballspieler, es passt nit as nen Karspiel. Weil sie seht, zwei, drei Spikes und uns bei der Baseballspiel.
Marvin Miller, the labor leader who became one of the most important figures in all of baseball history by building the Major League Players Union into a force that revolutionized the game, died last week in Manhattan at the age of 95. When Marvin Miller was named executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association in 1966, club owners ruled with an iron fist, as they had since the 19th century. The reserve clause bound players to teams for as long as the owners wanted them, leaving them with basically no bargaining power. Come contract time, a player could expect an ultimatum, but not much more. The minimum salary was $6,000 a year, and it hadn't budged much for two decades. The average player's salary in Major League Baseball was $19,000. The pension plan was feeble, and player grievances could only be heard by the commissioner, who worked directly for the owners. By the time Marvin Miller retired at the end of 1982, 16 years later, he had secured a place on baseball's Mount Rushmore by forging one of the strongest unions in America, creating a model for those in basketball, football, and hockey. The average player's salary had reached $240,000, the pension plan had become generous, and players won free agency and had hired agents to issue their own demands. If the players had a grievance, they could turn to an arbitrator. Peter cites the impartial arbitrator who invalidated baseball's reserve clause and created free agency in 1975, called Marvin Miller the Moses, who led baseball's children of Israel out of the land of bondage. Today, the average major leaguer makes $3 million. Free agency and arbitration are accepted norms, and baseball is more profitable than ever for its owners, in spite of all of their predictions. Marvin Miller, more than anyone else, was responsible for the professional athlete of today, a pop culture star who commands astronomical salaries and moves from one team of choice to another. Although his contributions to baseball were compared to those of Babe Ruth and Branch Rickey, who broke the color line with Jackie Robinson coming to the Brooklyn Dodgers, that was Marvin Miller's team he rooted for in Flatbush as a Jewish kid, Marvin Miller still has not been recognized by the Baseball Hall of Fame. As he said, there's been a concerted attempt to downplay the union. It's been about trying to rewrite history rather than record it. They decided a long time ago they would downgrade any impact the union has had, and part of that plan was to keep me out of the Hall of Fame. He lost every vote for the Hall of Fame, but he should get in. Marvin Miller had the trust of the ballplayers. I don't know of anyone who changed the game more than Marvin Miller, said Robin Roberts, the Philadelphia Phillies Hall of Fame pitcher who played a key role in hiring Miller. His legacy is through his work, ballplayers for the first time attained dignity from the owners. The owners and their direct employees hated the urbane, calm Miller. When players first struck in 1972, Paul Richards, the longtime baseball executive, said, Tojo and Hirohito couldn't stop baseball, but Marvin Miller could. There was about Miller a wariness one would find in an abused animal, Bowie Kuhn, the baseball commissioner during most of Miller's tenure, wrote in his memoirs. It precluded trust or affection. But that's not how the players felt. They couldn't have done better than hire Marvin Miller, and the Hall of Fame should recognize what he accomplished. But now it will have to be posthumously. Lech l'shalom, Marvin. May he rest in peace. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews round the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, author and scholar Dr. Adina Barel, a children's author and a teen author of some 19 books for children, Chai plus one. The Shmona Esrei on weekdays has 19 blessings, so we'll call them 19 blessings. She's written poetry, nonfiction, currently heads the Association Somalion for authors of books for children and youth, is a member of the Hebrew Authors Association, and has written extensively on the children's newspapers written in Hebrew and Yiddish in Poland between the wars. We started talking, Adina, at the beginning of the show, about how you became interested in writing about the Holocaust as a second-generation survivor. And you mentioned you really came about writing the fact by writing the fiction, by writing the story of a kid who was writing about the experience. Yes. Tell us a little bit about how that fiction works, and tell us also, maybe more importantly to start with, tell us about how did these kids' newspapers flourish? What exactly were they in the period between World War I and World War II in Europe?
Okay. So I was surprised to find that hundreds of periodicals had been published in Poland in three languages, Polish, Jewish periodicals in Polish, Hebrew, and Yiddish. And I began to look for the material, of course, in our wonderful National Library in Jerusalem. And then I went to Poland three times, every time for one whole month. And I found in the National Library in Warsaw many publications that the Poles kept, and they kept it very well. And my dissertation is a comparison between two wings, two aspects between the Yiddish children's periodicals of the Bundist movement and the Hebrew periodicals of the Zionist.
And these were two groups in interwar, the period between the wars in Europe.
Yes.
The Zionists, of course, advocating for movement to Israel, the founding of a Jewish state, which didn't happen until 1948. The Bundists, very much part of Yiddish culture and not interest, socialist by and large.
Yes, they were socialist and they...
Actually, a lot of the Zionists were socialist too, but never mind that.
Yes, but the Bundists decided that they have to stay in their countries in Europe and in America and to join the workers of all the world, the world movement of the workers. And because of that, I saw many differences between the Yiddish and the Hebrew periodicals. The Hebrew periodicals mentioned very much Eretz Israel, and they brought their young readers statisticals, information, and stories about what happened in Eretz Israel those days. It was at the 30s of the 20th century, and the Yiddish periodical even they didn't mention even Eretz Israel. They spoke a lot about Jewish Yiddish writers like Shalom Malachem, Peretz,
Yitzchak Leib Peretz, Mendeley Mocher Sforim.
Mendeley Mocher Sforim. You know that Mendeley is called the grandfather of the Yiddish literature. Shalom Aleichem, the father, and Peretz, the grandson of the Yiddish literature.
I always think of Peretz as the black sheep of Yiddish literature. He's always got a little zets.
Yes, but they say that when Peretz died, they found on his desk poems for children. Hmm. And this was new for me too. Yes, because I didn't know
he'd written any poetry.
Yes, yes. And I found even his works for children in those periodicals.
Tell us a little bit about your own work. You've written extensively for children and then for teens. Did you start out writing for children because you had small children, or what was the motivation?
Yes, I started, if I have time, I can tell.
Yes.
My first book was when I was pregnant. My first book was when I was pregnant, my second time, and my eldest son, Nir, was 4 years old. One night he woke up and cried, and we went to his bed and asked him, Nir, why are you crying? He said that he wants to go and live with grandma. We asked him, why is grandma? So he told us, soon you will have another child and you will not need me anymore. So I decided to write a book about what happens in the family and how the parents love all their children. So this was the first. Then for teenagers, I had a friend that had been killed in the 1973 war, in the Yom Kippur war. So his mother asked me to write a book about himself, and that she asked that it will not be a sad book. So I wrote about our lives in our being in the youth movement in Eretz Israel and so on. So it is very, I wrote other books for small children and other books for teenagers. I realized that one day when I taught in my college about children literature, and one of my students asked me to summarize in one sentence my writing. And without thinking, I told her, I'm writing for small children, happy and cheerful stories, and for teenagers, serious stories. And then I began to think about it, and I realized that it is right. And I think that the reason is because I am a daughter of survivors, and my childhood was not so happy because I heard all the stories that my mother told me. And now I want for my students, my children, and my grandchildren to create a happy world. But the teenagers have to know about what happened to us, to the humanity, and I tell them about the Holocaust and about other serious subjects.
And maybe teenagers are more prepared to understand
yes,
that
they
than
are
younger
more
kids.
Prepared, and this is very interesting how my research is connected with my teaching, because I had been a lecturer in an academic college with trans teachers. So when I was a small child and the teacher told us about the Shoah, he told us about burning bodies and so awful stories. And I came to the conclusion that we have to tell the small children about the life, the way of life between the wars, about what I had researched, yes, about their small Moishele and Rivkale that lived in Poland and had Polish friends and so on. And this is a preparation to know about the great loss of the Shoah. And when the students are growing up, we can tell them the all the facts, all the awful facts about the Holocaust.
I want to thank Dr. Adina Barel for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Are any of your books available in English now?
Not yet. For my visit here, we translated the six short stories about Israel, but I hope to. By the way, one of my books was translated to Arabic.
To Arabic, good.
Yes, in Israel.
Well, maybe now from Arabic to English.
Maybe now from Arabic to English, and I enjoy being here and meet wonderful people.
Bahatzlacha. Thank you, Adina, for a delightful visit. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Moshe Barel, an Israeli agronomist and an expert on olives and olive oil, entirely appropriate for the first morning of Hanukkah next Sunday. Our playout this morning is also from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Festival of Lights coming up this Saturday night, December 8th, for 8 great nights. It's from reggae star Matis Yahu, and it's his new song called, appropriately, Happy Hanukkah. My friends, have a wonderful beginning to Hanukkah, a Chag Hanukkah Sameach, and may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Tonight is the night, sunset, twilight, head back, come along, take flight. I am twinkling, I'm sprinkling, I'm shooting in the sky, I'm shining, I'm feeling alright. Light a candle for the one you love. With sunlight from below to above. 8 nights, celebrate till I fly in the sky like a dove. Let me unwind as I light up a flame in the name of the Lion of Judah. Drop like a hammer when I fall like the rain, sun shower.